And we are back with episode 817 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Washington Heights. And wait a minute, since when does the men's champion at Wimbledon get to decide who the next doctor is?
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and wait a minute, there's TV shows on? I was still in the movie theaters. I didn't think we were going back to TV yet, but okay.
Well, it's been a while, so I can imagine why you may have thought that. Yes, we are coming back from what was supposed to be a two-week hiatus and turned into a month hiatus because of various reasons, not the least of which are personal travel and work travel and holidays and everything else. And then just basically there's not been a lot on. We've had a pretty slow summer, and quite frankly, we kind of took advantage of that to a degree. So, yeah, we also wanted to come back with Edmund in the fold, and hey, Edmund, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yes, and so we are going to change the way that we do things a little bit over the course of the next few episodes this week. So, yeah, just kind of strap in. We're going to talk about some shows, but we're probably not going to do it quite episodically like we've done before. We're probably going to speak more about what we think of the shows to the degree that we have caught up with them, because some of us are a little more behind than others. So, yeah, it's just going to be a little bit more of a free-form conversation about some of these shows and other things that we have caught in the theater or just in general. So, yeah, I guess the first thing that we should talk about here, rather than get into our own experiences over the last month, is, well, there was a little bit of news that came out today from across the pond. Edmund kind of alluded to it already. So, yeah, guys, the 13th Doctor is a woman. Wow. What do we think of that? Who wants to jump in first?
Well, I'm perfectly fine with it. Certainly, some of the reactions, both for and against, was I certainly did kind of anticipate, given the various brouhahas that have cropped up around Star Wars and Ghostbusters and all that sort of thing in the last year or so. But certainly on the flip side, I was very gratified to see the number of women, and especially some of the videos of reactions from little girls who were just extremely chuffed and pleased that the Doctor was going to be a girl just like them. So certainly the whole idea of a time-traveling, shape-shifting alien with hearts can't appear in this guise. Especially after they had kind of foreshadowed it and primed the pump a bit with Missy, is I find quite silly. I'm looking forward to both a new Doctor and to see what Mr. Chibnall can do with the grand old franchise.
How about you, Gary? Similar thoughts?
Very much so. I'm really open to anyone at all. I would just hope that they don't... handle it too much in a mocking sense. Of course, I realize at some point he'll run across someone he knows and there'll be some sort of a guffaw or joke about it, but I hope they just sort of take that in stride and move forward with the story rather than focus on the gender, because in a lot of ways, I suppose with the exception of perhaps the River Song sort of ongoing storyline, he's been to some extent rather, you know, asexual. He's never really had any sort of... The Doctor has never had any type of love interest or stuff like that, because I almost get the sense that in some ways, you know, the Doctor is outside the story to some extent, it always feels like. And I'm curious if this means now that they will pull him sort of back in and give him all sorts of either romance or some or more family drama than we experienced during the whole Pond River Song type of thing. And I hope they just go forward with straight stories and get us settled in before they choose to venture in that way, should they choose to do so.
Yeah, my own reaction is that, yeah, it's probably well past due, right? But at the same time, I'm kind of glad that they're doing it when it is not Steve Moffat as the head writer. I think that he has definitely kind of, if I say it generously, he has kind of run his course.
Yeah, he scraped the bottom of the well, then dug about another foot or two deeper, full of mud, and that's where we're at now. Yeah.
Because, there's, run his course might be another way to put it, or we're not as welcome for some people. So I feel like, yeah, I am glad that he stuck with the end of the 12th Doctor as much as I liked Capaldi. I know that, Gary, you had a different feel for the 12th Doctor, but I feel like, yeah, bring everything to a relative close and then let the new guy come in, you know, change things up and really put his own mark on things. Because that's what Moffat really was trying to do all the time, was kind of like be the person who put his name stamped on these major things in the continuity and in the history of Doctor Who. And certainly he got to do that with the 50th and everything else. So, it's good that somebody else is really getting to kind of lead the way in having the first female doctor. I think that, as you said, Edmund, they really laid the groundwork already for this with Missy, and that was extremely well received. So I think that, yeah, the time has come. And one thing that I really liked about it is that even some of the people, I mean, yeah, there are some negative reactions out there, but those people were probably always going to have a negative reaction whenever this happened. What I'm kind of gratified to see is that some people that really were kind of dreading the idea as soon as it was actually announced kind of went back and said, you know what, no, let's see where this goes and give it a chance. Okay, that's more like the audience of Doctor Who that I'm used to hearing from, not, you know, the automatic negativity that some people were throwing out there. But some of those folks are probably the ones that were more enamored of the Doctor when he was a, you know, handsome, younger man type of Doctor. So maybe they were more into that kind of thing, and that's why they're not as enthusiastic, whatever the case may be. At this point, this is where they're going. I'm excited to see how next series shapes up. And I hope that this isn't the other, you know, the only major change that Chibnall brings to the table. I really want to see them take some chances, because at this point, what do they have to lose? Honestly.
Yeah, well, and I mean, isn't this what Doctor Who sort of is known for? It's constantly reinventing itself. So I was a little surprised at some of the negativity I heard, too. It's like, they shuffle things up every few years, guys. Haven't you figured that out yet? But I don't know. I wonder if what we're hearing too isn't so much the necessarily because of the sex of the next Doctor, but rather the complaints you seem to get every time the Doctor switches over. You have people who enjoy the current Doctor, who are fed up with, you know, don't want to leave them yet, feel there's more story potential, and they are just sort of upset of any change, not specifically, you know, the Doctor going female. And it's almost blurring it to some extent as far as I'm seeing, because I'm just seeing people not happy with the change. I don't hear that, at least that many people complaining, oh, it's a woman. I just hear them not happy that it's changing. So at least that's, I didn't see a lot of misogynist comments, at least in that so far. So I think it's just our, as you were saying, John, it's just our usual humbug change people that is that are expressing their discontent.
Yeah, there are definitely those who are doing that, and quite frankly, I understand. As a, you know, as a fan of the 12th Doctor, I'm not happy to see him go either, and I really am not particularly happy to see him go after a season that I didn't overly enjoy. But then again, there are some people who felt like this was the best season of his run. That's the thing with Doctor Who, is that, okay, you'll get a run with a certain combination of Doctor and companions and writers, and just wait long enough, and yeah, you'll get another combination soon enough.
Yeah.
Keep an open mind, and I bet it really, ultimately, you know, it's the writing. If the storytelling is good, people are going to warm up pretty fast, because she's a great actress, so...
Yeah, and actually, that's something I just wanted to bring up. I was realizing we've kind of fallen into the trap of just talking about what the gender of the new Doctor is and not mentioning that it is Jodie Whittaker. And I've actually had the seasons 2 and 3 of Broadchurch sitting on my DVR for ages and haven't gotten around to them, and they just moved right up to the top of the list.
There you go.
I definitely want to see that previous work that she's gotten so much praise for before the new season comes out next year.
I agree. That would probably be a good idea. So, okay. Let's see. So, yeah, any other thoughts about the announcement of the next Doctor?
Well, you know, it hasn't been talked about, but I wonder where we're going to be at with companions now. Do we keep... Jeez, I keep blanking out on his name, but...
Nardole?
Nardole is still around, right?
Apparently, so, yes.
So I believe Bill's gone, but Nardole's still there, so will we get to see Nardole? Or, they typically carry over a companion, so I am curious, but it didn't seem like at least Bill's coming over, but I was curious about the rest, so we'll have to see.
Yeah, my read on that was that he also was pretty much coming to a conclusion after this series, because I think they wanted a pretty blank slate. What do you think, Edmund? I know they left it a little bit open, but...
Yeah. For both of them, Bill's just off swanning around the universe, so it doesn't mean that she and the pilot couldn't turn up again. But yeah, most likely it's a clean break. And I kind of got the sense with Nardole that he was being given some pretty major responsibility that may curtail his traveling around and doing all those fun things with the Doctor. He, of course, never got to do that much since he was guarding the vault most of the time. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that what could happen is that they left things open in the story of the ship and the Cybermen, right? So they could revisit it in that respect, of going back and following up on it if they wanted to. I think it's kind of leaving the door open. At the same time, I feel like, yeah, it's kind of... I think they probably want to just go ahead and start fresh. Now, I think it would be hilarious if they decided to do, like, a Christmas special that was nothing but Clara and... and Bill and their respective friends hanging out, careening around the universe and running into each other. Because at this point, Moffat has so many ex-companions just kind of hanging out in the universe that you could probably have that happen. But what I would imagine could happen and would be really interesting to see is that now, of course, that they've cast a female doctor is to have a strong male companion, which I don't think they've had a strong male companion as a lead companion since the reboot of the franchise with the Ninth Doctor. So, quite honestly, this is probably their best opportunity to do so. They certainly could stick with the way that they've been doing things if they really wanted to go and challenge people's perceptions, but... I'd like to see someone, a male companion that isn't second fiddle to the female companion. I mean, Rory was great, but he was never the top billing companion-wise. Jack even really wasn't the top companion. Rose was always kind of overshadowing and so forth. So, I'd like to see that happen. And I think that would change up the dynamic quite a lot for the people who have only been watching it since... the return. So, any other thoughts?
No, I'm curious where they'll go, if they'll retread old villains or shoot out something new, but we'll have to just wait and see about that. So,
I think retreading old villains is kind of a Doctor Who trope at this point.
Well, I know, I'm just hoping... I'd love to not see a Dalek the first episode as well, I guess, is where I'll leave it. But
yeah, I am curious where they're going to go with that. But yeah, like Edmund was saying, I think even in the classic era, every single new Doctor had to have their Dalek episode, their Cybermen episode, their Master episode. So.
Not necessarily the first one, but it will happen.
Yes. All right, so... good way to start off our discussion here. Let's kind of dial a little bit back in our own time machine here and go over some of the other things that we've been up to this month. How many of us saw Spider-Man Homecoming?
Oh, I did.
Not yet, but feel free to go ahead. I've been hearing so much already. I'm in this strange position once again of I have access to a screening, but for some reason I'm not going to get to see it for another week. Not exactly a preview screening, whatever the opposite of that is.
Understood. Yeah, we'll get into it a little bit here, but for me, I was just really pleased with the way that they did things, mainly because, as I'm sure you already know, they did not do the origin story again.
Thank you!
Yes! Oh, thank goodness they didn't, right? Instead, they really just did, you know, a follow-up, essentially, to his appearance in Civil War. And for those who were wondering if this was going to be mostly a Spider-Man movie with just a few pepperings of stuff from the MCU, no. This is an absolutely filled to the brim MCU movie with Spider-Man in it. It's still his movie, but it is very much deep in the lore of the MCU, and you get the sense that this is them really integrating him in a deep way. Gary, how about you? I know that you enjoyed it because you were just as happy as I was when you were posting about it that weekend. So.
I thought they did a wonderful job, and I guess it almost, in some ways, it actually overlapped the Avengers Civil War, because we actually did get to see what led up to his appearance there and the immediate result afterwards. So it bookended in some ways his appearance there, because we got to see the full circle of how he showed up. And so I enjoyed that sort of type of storytelling that we now sort of have the whole picture. Because, you know, he showed up, we didn't know much about him other than it was something to do with, you know, Tony Stark. But now we actually did get the whole thing. So if you sort of go back and rewatch it, it sort of makes a lot more sense. So I like that. The thing I liked it about, well, there was a lot of things I liked, but one of the things that stood out to me was that the story was told as a teenager story. Too many of the last few Spider-Man movies honestly treat him like he's 35 years old. And this was nice. He's a kid, and they made no illusions about it. He didn't try to carry himself off more adult-like or more had heavy responsibility on his shoulders, you know, as we typically see with the origin story after Uncle Ben's killed. And I liked it. It really harkened me back to, and while it does predate me, I have read some of the early, you know, 60s, Ditko Spider-Man, where he's in high school and has to put up with the crap from Flash and stuff like that. And I really felt they captured it very well. It was, I don't want to say it was like I was reading a comic book, but I felt like whatever's source of inspiration was tapped for that book back then, that they managed to hit the same vein with it, because it was really done in character for that time.
Yeah, it really was. And this being the first time we really got to see him in the high school setting, like you said, he is a teenager, and I like the fact that he starts off almost in a, he's almost, I wouldn't say that he's hard to, that he's in, you know, that he's hard to relate to, or that he is, you know, not sympathetic, but at the same time, he doesn't start off as some perfect, you know, like you said, even though Uncle Ben has died, and one would expect that he has gotten the, you know, with great power comes great responsibility line somewhere along the lines, he's still learning in a big way.
No, well, that's the whole thing, though. I don't think he's there yet, which is nice for a change. As I said, yeah, he's often early burdened, and it makes them treat him as a much older or wise character, and he's not. He's screwing up left and right all over the place, and it's great to see young superhero who does not know the ropes. It's nice to see him have to stumble and fall and, oh geez, I lost my clothes for the third time, and you know, and all these things that he just doesn't get. That, you know, I, you know, especially John, you and I as both parents, you know, the teenagers are doing that sort of stuff all the time, regardless of, you know, being bit by a spider. So it's really down to earth. It rings true. And I was extremely happy with it. I think everything worked out really well. I thought the supporting cast was good. I did thoroughly enjoy it, but I felt his, and I don't remember the actor's name in the movie, but his, I'll just refer to him as his sidekick. I thought they went a little bit almost slapsticky with him, which I felt was just a hair too much sometimes, it felt like. But that was probably my, yeah.
Okay.
Was that Ned? Yeah.
Yeah,
that was my you know, small, tiny complaint. I just felt they used him, not only used him as comic relief, but almost stupidly so sometimes. So I wish they had just pulled back a hair on that. But, you know, that worked out well. I actually did not get enough to see of Melissa Tomei to really have a sense of her character. She, you know, she did have very little dialogue, in my opinion, and it was hard to really get a sense of her. So I'm hoping the next one might give us a few more minutes with her, so we'll have to see about that. But
I do agree with you on that, in that we're so used to Aunt May being the primary parental figure that if there's one thing that they did do by tying him so strongly to Tony Stark is that they kind of took away a bit, I think, from Aunt May's parental role, because they pretty much made Tony Stark a bit of a father figure. And while they did it in a very tongue-in-cheek way a lot of the time, I think that did take some of the focus off of Aunt May as one of Peter's primary influences in life.
Yeah, somebody who grounds him, yes.
Yeah. And so I do think that mix was a little bit off. If there was one thing about the movie that kind of that did stick out to me, but I do think that there's something very meta and appropriate for a movie where Tony Stark is the is a supporting character, but he makes himself more important than his role should be. It's just very Stark. I could say the same thing about Civil War. It's not his movie, but boy, did he make it about himself. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think that it was a strong entry into the MCU. I think that it fits really well. I think that it still has its own voice, which is good.
And so did the suit.
Yes. Which was pretty hilarious in its own way. But yeah, that I liked the fact that actually this if you look at it from the MCU perspective, this is a really nice follow-up to some of what was in not just Civil War, but Iron Man 3. Because one of the lessons that, you know, semi-parental Tony Stark gives him is if you're no one without the suit, then you don't deserve to be wearing it.
Yes.
And that's kind of what Tony learned in Iron Man 3. So he didn't learn it particularly well, but he learned it. But I like
he heard the message. Yeah,
yeah,
I don't
yeah.
know if it's so hard, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he is Tony Stark. So, but what I do like about the fact is that he is, if nothing else, there is a sense of continuity there. And thematically, it really feels like it hits home. So, yeah, to me, that worked out pretty well.
And, you know, we're focusing on sort of one side of the story. I wanted to come across the side that really impressed the heck out of me was Michael Keaton as Vulture. I thought he did an amazing job. It's wonderful that they cast, that they have a villain who is literally in it for the money. He doesn't have any grand plans of taking over the world. He's not homicidal and insane the way that Green Goblin's been in the last few Spider-Man pictures. He's a man that's just, you know, trying to get a job done, and while illegally, he's, you know, he's just, you know, he just wants to keep his head down, get this done, and be on his way. He doesn't want to fight Parker on top of the Empire State Building. He doesn't want to, you know, drive everybody crazy. It's just, he was a very believable MCU villain.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he's not a Thanos or some galactic thing. He's, you know, he's a guy who got his hand on some alien tech and is using it for his, albeit illegal, benefit. And I thought the character came across very well. He was focused and purposeful and tough without being, as I said, without being nuts or, you know, suicidal or so blindly devoted to his cause that it stopped him, you know, from acting rationally. So I liked him. I liked it a lot. I liked the character. I liked the actor, the way he was portrayed. How about you, John? Was that, what'd you think about it? I thought it was great to not have a mustache twirling villain.
No, and it made perfect sense within the MCU that you'd have people like this. I thought his motivations were interesting in that he had reasons for what he was doing.
Mm.
And he just kept, it just kept escalating to the point where he did become this, this villain and someone who was willing to kill for what he was doing and so forth. So yeah, I thought that it was actually nice that you had someone that grounded. Like you said, this is someone whose motives we can understand. I've got to maintain, you know, I'm in it for the money. And yes. At some point, the money becomes so good that any threat to that becomes escalated as a result.
Mm.
And, yeah, I can't say that, you know, oh, anybody would do what he did, because he did cross the line pretty quickly. But it had been years of this operation. And,
yeah
he had built from someone who had been, you know, just trying to make a living to, yeah, now he's pretty much a criminal mastermind, but it was still small potatoes compared to other things. You know, it was only when it escalated to a certain degree that it became noticeable, so to speak. But yeah, it's I definitely liked his performance. I thought that it kept things within the box that the movie needed to be in to be believable as a, you know, smaller type of scale. It fit very nicely in between, say, the Netflix Marvel show level and the MCU, you know, Avengers level. It was, it really fit in there pretty well. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I want to say another thing that they sort of captured that's the mystique of Spider-Man, or at least how I read it, is several of his villains usually have a very close personal connection to him, and they managed to set up and execute that trope perfectly with him. You know, as they're sitting in the car and they both sort of realize what's going on, and they're having this, you know, this pages-long conversation with just a few words, and you see the hurt come over Peter and stuff like this, you know, and it often reminds me, for those of our listeners not versed in comic books, you know, besides, of course, you know, Green Goblin being his best friend's father, he's also had, let's see, there was a Dr. Connors who became the Lizard that he had worked under for a while, and he's had, you know, some other run-ins with these, you know, with villains who have some sort of close personal relation to him, and it's, you know, it's not just a matter of punching out the villain, it's a matter of dealing with all these emotions that it drags up, that, you know, this was someone that I, you know, respected or worked with or, you know, had feelings for in some cases, and now they're, you know, they're literally turned against me trying to kill me, and, you know, in some ways that becomes a much more, it's a much more personal conflict than it is just some random guy shooting a laser beam at you trying to kill you. And, you know, you're like, oh, what, you know, what do I do? Can I, you know, I can't, I don't want to hurt the guy too much, but he's trying to kill me. I got to take him out. And as I said, this has been a trope ongoing with Parker since the Green Goblin, as I said, Dr. Connors, not to mention the various clone sagas that went on through the comic books. And it's nice that they chose to do it without going over the top as they do with Green Goblin. So that was another nice trope that they pulled in from the mythos, which I thought they did well.
Definitely. Definitely. You know, I'm hoping that Sony doesn't go too far with kind of undermining that in further films, but we'll have to see exactly where they follow up from here. But Yeah. This one was a good start, to say the least. Go ahead, Edmund.
I just wanted to jump and say, not having seen it, hearing you guys talk about it is just making me more and more excited since, you know, I'm being a little bit older than you guys, and while I didn't get into comics as much as you two did overall, Spider-Man was the first one who I really got into back in the mid-70s, and of course, thanks to Stan and the editing staff always throwing in those little footnotes and allusions to the previous issues and all the stories I'd missed. You know, I did go back and, you know, go through Green Goblin and Gwen Stacy's death and the earlier stuff, and hearing that they're really going back to those early high school days and making him the wisecracking teenager again, which was, well, you know, which certainly was obvious from his you know, from when he popped up in Civil War. It's really nice to see that hear that they've followed through on that.
Oh yeah, definitely. If you were a fan of the early 70s, at least, yeah, you definitely have a lot of nice feelings about as you watch the movie. So,
excellent.
Yeah. So yeah, I would definitely say that that's a another winner for the MCU. Let's see here now, then.
I did hear that the 2 weeks after release have already dropped down substantially in dollar figures. So I don't know if it'll ever hit that crazy level. But I believe it's only been released domestically and it already has made money. So I don't think we should be too worried about the chances for another one.
Oh no, I don't think that there's any issues there. I think that hopefully they didn't have any completely crazy expectations for this. You know, it's hard these days because, especially when movies are making less and less, it seems, because of all the competition, that, yeah, it's kind of hard for some of these expectations, excuse me, to be met. But yeah, it's already exceeded its budget, and actually it did open internationally, and it's already internationally or worldwide almost at $500,000. So,
oh wow, okay.
Billion, yeah, so it's just under $500 million. So I think it's fine. And I'm not surprised that it dropped, because quite frankly it's the summer movie season, and if anything they underestimated the interest in the Planet of the Apes movie, because that was higher than expectations. So, yeah. To me, it just makes sense that, yeah, a movie like that, that a lot of people were anticipating, and there were a lot of people that, I think, it's fair to say that no matter how good this Spider-Man movie was going to be, they've gone to the well so many times that there are some people who are just fed up and don't want to see another Spider-Man movie. So, you know, the MCU faithful came out for it, and then we'll see what kind of legs it has when it's up against less competition in the next couple weeks, because yeah, there's still going to be some competition. Things like Valerian and stuff are going to be a little bit more niche, I think, than say Planet of the Apes, since it's kind of ending a trilogy, as they say. So we'll have to find out. All right. That having all been said, we can delve a little bit into what else we've been up to. But Edmund, since you haven't had a chance to really weigh in, what are your thoughts? What have you been up to since we last talked?
Partially hard at work at this job, so I haven't had time for a lot of extracurricular stuff. But I have been continuing to make my way through the Attack on Titan manga. I'm still pretty much, I'm about halfway through the events of the first season. But it is certainly helping to fill the void that the end of the second season has left, and it is nice sort of getting that different view of it, and a little bit of extra info and background. And on the TV front, I actually, with the Leftovers ending, I had some friends who hadn't really gotten into it and were asking me about it, and actually wound up going through and rewatching. Admittedly, they're the shorter seasons, all three seasons, in the last month or so, and just happy to report that it really does hold up. Although watching it all at once, I'm starting to think season two may actually be my favorite, because I think in season three they really wound up focusing so much on Kevin and Nora, making it so much their story that it did lose some of those wider family issues and family events and dynamics that they had, I think particularly in season two. But certainly happy to report that The Leftovers holds up just as well as we might have hoped it would as it finished up. And also, I have been finally making my way through further into Deadwood. I am now into the third season, and already mourning that I'll be reaching the end soon. But it's also been a lot of fun seeing some of the actors who I got to know in later roles, particularly Jim Beaver, who is absolutely wonderful as Elwood, the honest and upright prospector. And also seeing Garrett Dillahunt play an absolutely terrifying psychotic geologist in ways that reminded me a lot of his turn on Burn Notice a few years later. But yes, scarily competent, but someone who will slit your throat at a moment's notice, as we get to see a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in broad terms, I agree with you about The Leftovers, that, yeah, it did kind of become a little more, the scope was a little more isolated to just a few characters, mm-hmm. and I think that did take away from the tapestry that the second season was. I do feel like the second season was their really the high point. As much as I really love the way that the series ended, it did seem like there was something lost in the third season somewhere.
And yes, Gary, that was the over-under at 37 minutes.
That's okay. I was in for under 20, so I'm good.
Yeah. Let's see here. Gary, how about you? Any highlights? I believe that there was some travel involved somewhere in there.
Oh, sweet heavens, yeah. Well, I mentioned it a few times. I took that amazing trip to New Mexico with my Boy Scout troop. I swore that 2 days during the course of the time I was going to die. I even hallucinated for a little while. And while I wish I could say it was of anything that was either pretty or amazing, it really wasn't. They were mundane things I thought I saw. That's what over 11,000 feet will do to you. But I had a great time. It was more physically demanding than I ever imagined, and thanks to working together as a group, I survived. I'm thrilled I did it. I wish I could do it again, just not too soon. It was great. We were sort of joking. We're at almost 12,000 feet, and we're as a little science fiction nod, I said, "Do you realize outside of a vehicle, this is the closest we'll probably ever get to space?" No, we had a great time. It was wonderful. Weather was perfect. Every night, as I said, we stopped at a camp where there was always some sort of activity, whether it was a sing-along. One night it was whoever could tell the best story contest won an apple. Now, that may not sound like much, but when you are 3 to 5 days away from civilization, apples are pretty scarce, so it became quite a competition. One of the odd highlights was a woman playing an accordion on top of a roof, and it sounded beautiful. I had a great time. We panned for gold. We did a whole bunch of stuff. There really wasn't much TV to watch out there, though. There wasn't even cell phone signal for most of the time. But I had a great time with that, and thankfully, that has... I've completed now what has amounted to a almost a 2-year-long stretch of preparation, planning, and research to do that trip. So I look forward to the respite, and I'm sort of twiddling my thumbs as to what I'm going to do with all my spare time. Now, I still have a few, I have actually 3 business trips this month, so as soon as I finish those, things will start to calm down again. So I'm looking forward to time to watch my shows, actually. They're backing up on the DVR a whole bunch.
Yeah, I can imagine. Definitely. I'm usually, especially with so few things on TV, I would usually be up to date with, except for the shows that are running tonight. And I haven't even touched any of the shows since a week ago. Mm-hmm. So, I've had other things that have been taking up my time. Not the least of which is, Edmund, I'm sure you'll be happy to hear this, I ripped through Leviathan Wakes in 10 days. And the last 200 pages were on Friday night.
Oh, yeah.
I was not stopping till I was done.
Yes. that'll happen.
Yeah.
We've all been guilty of that. Oh, geez, it's 3:30, but look, I only got like a quarter inch of pages left. Keep going.
Exactly. It's interesting because even though, for those who may not be familiar with the title, Leviathan Wakes is the first book of the Expanse novel series. And it essentially was adapted into the first season and a half, roughly, of the Expanse, the TV series. But what I did not realize, because I watched the show first before reading the book, was that, on the show, they bring in a lot of other perspectives and points of view. In the novel, it really does focus in very much on the perspectives of Miller and Holden. So yes. A lot of events are happening off the page, so to speak, in the background that we actually get to see a little bit more of in the show. So just on that basis alone of being able to see the difference in the adaptation versus the original was pretty fascinating because there are some key differences along the way, although it is a pretty close adaptation. And just beyond that, it's really written. First of all, these are contemporaries of George R. R. Martin, which I didn't realize that. Small world. But that explains why he is so prominently quoted on the cover. But yeah, that same sense of tapestry and putting all the pieces together and then really driving to a finish that were in the first few novels of Game of Thrones novels. You can definitely see that they learned a lot of the same lessons, and there is also a certain degree of synergy because I listen to The Churn, which is the official Expanse TV series podcast, and the authors are prominently on that podcast. So I've heard their perspective on the show, on how it was adapted from their original material, and now I've read the original material. It really kind of gives you this sense of the creative process and just an appreciation for the original work. Definitely took a little bit of getting used to the writing style. It's not too weird, but it is very cinematic in its own way, but I really enjoyed that first book. It was extremely readable, and I do have the second one sitting right over there, but I'm taking a little bit of a break.
That one drives to quite a climax as well, by the way.
Ooh.
which we have not seen on the screen yet.
Yes, we've only seen essentially the first half of that book, I think they said. So
yes.
Yeah, so this will be the first time, actually, probably I'll get to that before the third season comes out at this rate. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see, read up to the point that they are in the show and then eclipse it a bit. I like how the TV series is beyond the material for Game of Thrones as it airs, as we speak.
Indeed. And and I just wanted to say, I mean, I know I found for me, I mean, it's interesting that you have the experience of doing it the other way around, but especially having read I'm working on the third, haven't finished it yet, but having read the first two, going through these first two seasons, you know, it really felt like, you know, no, I mean, getting those extra perspectives and, you know, sort of those deeper perspective in some of the characters, really did, you know, just enhance the TV viewing experience. And, you know, but that was mainly because the adaptation has been so good. You know, it wasn't a case of sitting there going like, oh, but they left this out and they forgot this crucial part. It was like, you know, no, they managed to take the essence of the characters in the situation and distill it down for TV. But sort of having the book experience and, you know, knowing a little bit more about the characters just added to it.
Yeah, definitely. And like I said, having the writers actually part of the adaptation in a very close way, they get to kind of revisit some of their choices in some cases where they say, hey, no, because this is an adaptation, the way we did it in the book really wouldn't work. We've got to do it a different way. And I'm thinking specifically about the way that they handled things in the beginning of the second book. With Bobby and all of that. I haven't read it, obviously, but I heard what happens in the book versus what they did on the show. And that was one of the moments that I really kind of sat back and went, that's a brilliant observation to have that as a creator, to have that insight of your own story, to be able to listen to somebody and say, no, it really needs to play out differently, and recognize the value of adapting for the medium and for the audience accordingly.
Yes.
Anyway, we are pretty much at the end of this episode, and so what we're going to do is go ahead and stop here, and then pretty much pick up from here when we start the next one. So, until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time. Watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.